Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
This is Michael Gibbons in Carson City. I'm joined today by Judge Jerry Tao in Las Vegas and Judge Bonnie Bulla in Las Vegas. You can differentiate the courtrooms by one's red and one's dark. And I see we have counsel here for both cases for today. Just a reminder, we've been doing electronic oral arguments since May. It's worked pretty well for the most part, but we have this procedure in place where we have backups in case there's a problem. So if there is something where the screen freezes or the sound's not coming through, we'll just pause and then try to hope it'll come back in a moment without us doing anything. If that doesn't work, then we have to go to alternative means. The court's assisted by its IT staff during the oral arguments. And you just heard Elizabeth Brown, the clerk of the Supreme Court, call this case to order. We really appreciate counsel participating in it this way. It's probably getting to be standard procedure now for everyone. But nonetheless, it is different. Judge Tao, do you want to say anything before we begin?
No, just again, thank you guys for accommodating us and working with our IT staff to get it done. I know it's not always, and I don't know how it went today, but it's not always an easy process. Sometimes it takes a couple rehearsals and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I guess this is the new normal. We're probably going to be in this, be conducting oral arguments this way at least for the next couple of months, it looks like, if not several months. Also, I believe that the first case that we have on the assault case, one of you is here in a pro bono capacity. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. This is Chris Mixon representing appellant pro bono.
Okay. Well, I wanted to thank you for doing that. As you guys know, there are always more cases than there are attorneys willing to handle them, and we really appreciate your taking the time to do this and to help us and your client out. We really want to thank you and hope that you'll take some more cases in the future.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will.
Okay. And that was Mr. Mixon speaking for the appellant, Ms. Yasul, and appearing for the respondent, the Green Hills. Who do we have?
Yes, Your Honor. This is Adam Trapedi for the respondent, Green Hills.
Okay. All right, thank you for being here today, too. Judge Bulla, do you have any opening comments?
Well, good morning to both of you. As you can see, Judge Tao and I are in the court room together, so we both have our masks on. We'll try to speak as clearly as possible, but if you do not understand one of us, please let us know, and we will restate the question. We very much appreciate both of you being here today, and we look forward to your arguments.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right, Mr. Mixon, on behalf of Ms. Yasul, do you have do you want to reserve any time for a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to try to reserve 2 minutes.
2 minutes. All right. That will then be noted by the clerk. For the record, this is case 74683. Gloria Yasul versus Donna Greenhill and Lyle Greenhill. It's a time set for the oral argument. And this case has a lot of issues in it. It's been going on for quite a while. There's limited time for argument. The court certainly wants to hear about what happened here, but of course we've looked at the record, we've looked at the brief, so we have a pretty good idea. So we want to focus on the legal issues as much as possible, and specifically on the contempt related issues, if that's what you choose, Mr. Mixon. All right, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chris Mixon on behalf of appellant Gloria Yasul, and may it please the court. As you noted, there is a lot of history with this case. And so Ms. Yasul appeals from and seeks reversal of the final judgment for nuisance and trespass because the findings of fact are based almost entirely on inadmissible hearsay evidence. The district court found Ms. Yasul created a nuisance by harassing the plaintiff's tenants and that Ms. Yasul trespassed in the easement by preventing others from accessing it. but neither the tenants nor the workers who allegedly were harassed or denied access to the easement testified at trial. So Ms. Yassel was not able to cross-examine them. The only testimony at the time of trial from the plaintiff was from the plaintiff herself, Mrs. Greenhill, and she testified almost entirely on what other people had told her, not what she personally witnessed, which is the very definition of hearsay. Ms. Yassel, of course, denies that she harassed anyone, and she denies that she improperly prevented anyone from accessing the easement. So why did the district court issue a judgment that relies on hearsay? My argument is because it's because the district court has lost its impartiality by the time of trial because of the contentious pretrial proceedings revolving around the preliminary injunction, the contempt finding, Ms. Yassel's inability to pay the fine, the verbal orders converting the fine to community service and back to a monetary sanction, and ultimately Ms. Yassel's improper imprisonment. I want to be clear, I'm not alleging that the district court had malice against Ms. Yassel, only that it had lost its impartiality by the time. The district court may have felt justified in being frustrated with Ms. Yassel because of all the pretrial contempt activity. But the standard for the loss of impartiality is not based on what the district court felt.
Well, I mean, isn't there another explanation? And this is the danger that happens every time there's a bench trial, which is, you know, the advantage of having a juror is the judge sees all this pretrial stuff. He makes rulings on what's admissible and not admissible. And when you rule on it, you've obviously seen inadmissible evidence. But if there's a jury there, the jury doesn't know. They only hear the stuff that's admissible. But the danger of any judge who does a bench trial is, you know, it's our job to look at the motions in limine and the objections and to make a decision on what's admissible. But it's really hard to forget what you saw that was also inadmissible. Isn't that the easier explanation for what the judge is doing? Is maybe he just mixed up what he thought he remembered from the case because he's now sitting as the juror?
Well, I suppose that's possible, Your Honor, but I think, as I'll get to later, the real issue is the hearsay and the objections and overruling at trial, but also the actual final judgment is full of hearsay evidence. So whether or not the district court forgot that, he shouldn't have heard hearsay evidence, that evidence is what supports the final judgment, and that's really one of the cruxes of Ms. Yassel's claims on appeal.
Mr. Mixon, are you saying that there was no evidence that would not be classified as hearsay to support both trespass and nuisance? There was absolutely no other evidence that would have supported either of those two claims?
The only evidence that my review of the record shows that was not hearsay was that Ms. Greenhill at one time in maybe the 2010 or 2011 time frame was showing tenants to around her house and heard the dogs barking. And that's the only time that she personally witnessed any of the activities that make up the facts that support the nuisance and trespass claims.
Well, what about Ms. Yassel's own testimony and the photographs?
Well, I don't know which photographs or testimony specifically you're talking about, Your Honor, but the nuisance claim was about not letting people into the easement, as was the trespass claim. And the testimony from Ms. Greenhill established that all persons who requested access were ultimately granted it, although it may not have been immediate, I admit that.
Thank you.
Well, as I was saying, the standard for the district court's loss of impartiality is an objective one. It's whether a reasonable person would think, based on the record, that the district court had lost its impartiality. So what happened at trial to cause the district court to lose its impartiality? First, of course, was the preliminary injunction granted at the outset of the case. As I argued in the briefs, that preliminary injunction should never have been issued because there was no threat of irreparable harm. The plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction didn't set forth the standards for granting an injunction, and it didn't set forth any evidence of a threat of irreparable harm. When the allegation is a harm to property, the case law tells us that that threat must threaten a permanent loss of the property, a minor non-permanent encroachment of a property right is not irreparable harm sufficient to support a preliminary injunction. So the standard was not met here, and the injunction should never have issued in the first place. And then Ms. Yassel, while she was still representing herself, filed both an appeal of the injunction to the Nevada Supreme Court, and after the written order granting the injunction was filed, she filed a motion to stay that injunction. Nonetheless, the plaintiff filed its first motion for contempt against Ms. Yassel for not removing her planters from the easement while her two legal challenges were pending. And furthermore, that motion for contempt was filed before the injunction had actually gone into effect, because the injunction required the posting of a bond. The notice of entry of posting a bond wasn't until June 17th, 2013. That's 5 days after the motion for contempt was filed. So at the time the motion for contempt was filed, not only were there legal challenges by Ms. Yassel and her capacity representing herself, but the injunction itself wasn't even there. Nonetheless, the district court found her in contempt because she didn't remove her planters and fined her $2,800. At the hearing on that motion, Ms. Yassel told the court that she could never afford to pay the $2,800 fine because of her low income. A month later, the plaintiff filed a second motion for contempt, not because of the preliminary injunction, which by that time Ms. Yassel was in compliance with, but because Ms. Yassel hadn't paid the $2,800 fine. So at the hearing on the second motion for contempt, Ms. Yassel, still proceeding pro se, explained to the court that she was on a fixed Social Security income, which was approximately $700 a month, and after she paid all her bills, there was just simply not enough money left to pay the sanction. So at this hearing, the plaintiff's counsel suggests that her son should pay the fine. But ultimately, instead of holding her contempt for not paying the fine, the court ordered Ms. Yassel to gather her financial documents and bring them to a follow-up hearing. Then 2 weeks later, the plaintiff filed a third motion for contempt. This time it was for activities that are not part of the injunction itself, allegedly banging her chair against the house, banging her cane, taping the dryer vent shut, screaming obscenities. None of that was part of the original injunction. You couldn't support contempt of the injunction. So at the hearing on this third motion, Ms. Yassel brought her financial documents as the court required, but instead of reviewing them, the court told her to provide them to opposing counsel and that the court would hold a subsequent hearing to consider her financial condition and discuss next steps in terms of the sanction. Ms. Yassel complied. She provided her financial documents to plaintiff's counsel, but the follow-up hearing never occurred. Instead, the case appeared to go dormant for about 2.5 years. Until April of 2016, the plaintiff files a fourth motion for contempt, arguing that Ms. Yassel had put her planters and her chair back into the easement. Ms. Yassel erroneously thought that because the district court judge had changed and the case had gone dormant, that she didn't have to comply with the injunction. She had counsel by this time who informed her otherwise, and she immediately removed all these items from the easement. At the hearing on this fourth motion for contempt in May 2016, the district court verbally converted the sanction to community service because of the district court's frustration that Ms. Yassel couldn't pay the sanction. But no written order followed. There was never a written order converting the $2,800 fine into community service. And then a month later, there was another hearing. The district court ordered verbally that Ms. Yassel should complete 30 hours of community service per month. And plaintiff's counsel was ordered to file a written motion. That never happened. And so there was never a written order, telling Ms. Yassel specifically what the terms of the community service order were. So 1 month later, there was another hearing. Ms. Yassel's counsel informs the court that she'd been talking to a volunteer organization, but that there was a concern that because of her age and medical condition, she may not be able to comply physically with the service requirement. It was at this hearing in July 2016, the district court expressed great frustration with Ms. Yassel and her trial counsel, and a lot of that was because of the misunderstandings that were created by the lack of written orders about community service. So then a month later, the plaintiff files a fifth motion for contempt, This time it's for failure to complete the community service. In opposition, in writing for the first time, Ms. Yassel's pro bono trial counsel noted for the court that the court needed to put these orders in writing so that the terms were clear and not confusing. Then Ms. Yassel's trial counsel filed a formal motion for relief from the community service, attaching a note from her doctor and her medical records describing her medical condition that made it impossible for her to comply with the community service. This all came to a head in an August 24th hearing. The court, district court, continued to express frustration. Ms. Yassel's counsel tried to separate, in the district court's mind, the compliance with the injunction, which was still being complied with, and the sanction, which everyone agrees there was trouble. And plaintiff's counsel again suggests converting community service back to a fine and having Ms. Yassel's son pay it, which the court verbally orders and says, pay $500 in 2 weeks or you're going to go to jail, and quote, I don't care where the money is. But again, no written order followed this hearing, these verbal decisions of the court. But at this point, the die was cast. It was clear Ms. Yassel was unable to pay and it was going to cause her to end up in jail. So then in September 14th, 2016, there's another hearing. Ms. Yassel can't pay, but because of a lack of a written order, the district court continued the hearing to September 21. There's now a final order that says if she doesn't pay, she goes to jail. She can't pay, it's undisputed, and the court puts her in jail for 28 days. That imprisonment was improper, first because it was a violation of law. The Nevada Constitution prohibits imprisonment for inability to pay a debt. The United States Supreme Court in the Bearden case says you can only put someone in prison if their failure to pay a debt is willful, despite their ability to pay. And it's undisputed that Ms. Yassel did not have the ability to pay. Imprisonment was also improper because the community service was never reduced to a written order in its terms limit. And then finally, the prison was improper because its origin is traced back to the preliminary injunction that never should have issued, and the contempt order for not following should never have issued. So at trial, the only witness to testify, as we discussed, was the plaintiff, and all of her testimony was hearsay, except for, as we discussed, she witnessed the barking dogs early on in the case. And on cross-examination, Ms. Greenhill admitted that she lacked personal knowledge of Ms. Yassel ever denying anyone access to the easement, and she admitted that she lacked knowledge of her tenants allegedly being harassed by Ms. Yassel. The final judgment, nonetheless, finds harassment of the tenants, rocking a chair against the house, verbally harassing maintenance workers, tenants asking for discounts on rent, tenants breaking their leases, Ms. Yassel preventing people from entering the easement. All of that was based on hearsay testimony.
All right, Mr. Mixon, do you still want to save time for rebuttal?
Yes, I do. I would just conclude by saying, because of the district court's impartiality, it allowed hearsay testimony, which almost entirely supported the judgment, and therefore the judgment should be reversed. Thank you.
All right, 1 minute for a rebuttal then. All right, Mr. Trippietti, are you ready to go?
I am.
Proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court, again, this is Adam Trippietti on behalf of respondents Donna and Lyle Greenhill. This case is a classic example of the phrase nightmare neighbors, the type of thing you might see in a movie or a TV show where a person or people are terrorizing the neighborhood. Except for Donna and Lyle Greenhill, this wasn't a work of fiction. It wasn't something on TV or in a movie. This was their life for 7 years. For 7 years, they had to deal with the abuse from their neighbors, Miss Yassel and her son, to such an extent that they ultimately decided to sell their rental property rather than continue to deal with this abuse. And nightmare neighbor is not just my word. That's exactly what Judge Hardy called Ms. Yassel and her son after receiving all the evidence, the substantial evidence at the trial. So the Greenhills respectfully request this court affirm the district court's findings from the bench trial for the following, because there was substantial evidence to support those findings, even without the alleged hearsay, and I'll get into that. And as far as sending Monsieur Saul to jail, he openly defied and flouted and flagrantly violated court orders for years. And she was warned multiple times before she was sent to jail.
Well, let me, since you're bringing that up, let me ask you this question. What, you know, obviously we don't know what's going on between these neighbors. You know, all we have is what's in the transcript. But whatever is happening between the neighbors, the court, one of the issues here is what the court did. And it appears pretty clear to me that the nature of the contempt that the court imposed here was criminal rather than civil. It wasn't to induce behavior. It was to punish for past behavior. And once the court goes down the path of criminal contempt, it has certain procedural requirements, one of which is the contempt findings and what the person has to do has to be in writing. How does the court get to throw somebody in jail without written orders?
Your Honor, respectfully, there were written orders in place. There was an injunction in place. It was filed in June of 2013, as well as a bond was posted in 2013. So at that point, we have an effective preliminary injunction order, and Ms. Yasal refused to comply with that order.
Well, that, but wasn't the first, and I think this is probably Judge Bullock's exact question, wasn't the first finding of contempt based on conduct that happened before the written order was actually filed?
Your Honor, what happened was we had, there was an order to show cause filed by the Green Hills, and the judge granted an order to show cause. Then there was a several-hour evidentiary hearing. Because Ms. Yasal was acting pro se, Judge Escobar took the extraordinary step of holding, I think it was about a half-day evidentiary hearing, take evidence from witnesses as well as documentation. And she said it was the most thorough hearing she'd ever had on an injunction. After taking all of that substantial evidence, that body of evidence, only then did she issue an injunction. Then, after the injunction was issued, that's after that point, there was an order for an injunction, there was a bond posted, and then there was a hearing on that injunction violation. And at that hearing is when Judge Escobar imposed sanctions and attorney's fees against Ms. Yasal. So we do have written orders. We do have a history here. We do have a history of violations of those orders. And then, you know, to continue on with the contempt, because I see the court is interested in that issue. So I'll just go through the history of that. What Ms. Yasal is arguing is an oversimplification. This wasn't just a failure to pay fines and inability to pay fines. This was 3 or 4 years of flagrant violations of court orders. So I just explained why the original contempt order was issued by the court. It was after an injunction, it was after an evidentiary hearing, and it was based on violations of that injunction, which court found clearly there was, this was not a close call.
Mr. Trapedi, let me interrupt you just for a moment. At the time, though, that Ms. Yazel was sent to jail, prior to that, she had been in compliance with the preliminary injunction for at least a month. Is that right? So she had actually been in compliance. I believe she was actually in compliance at the time that the community service was ordered as well. Is that right?
I'll be honest. It's a tortured history. I can't remember on the exact date that the community service was discussed, what the status was. I can't give you that answer without spending a few minutes looking at the record. But what I can tell you is, yes, she was in compliance. At the time when she was put in jail, she was in compliance for a month, correct. But that ignores years of history of the case. This, as I said, there was an injunction, there was a contempt finding, and two separate judges over the course of 3 or 4 years held 9 separate hearings on compliance with the contempt order.
Compliance issue, sir, isn't so much that she didn't comply with the preliminary injunction, but that she hadn't paid the attorney fees, which were imposed nearly 2.5 years before the time she went to jail. Is that right? So it's really as a punishment for not paying the prior fees that were awarded?
Yes, but I think that's correct. But I think the fact that she continued to violate the preliminary injunction years after it was issued. So that also informed the court's decisions on these issues. It's not like she...
Sir, this case sat dormant for 2.5 years. Did your clients do anything during that period of time?
My clients did nothing. My clients were satisfied at that point because nothing bad was happening for a while. You know, thankfully, there was peace in this case for a couple years, and it only opened back up. And these contempt issues only came to the forefront because Ms. Yasal put her planters and her cinder blocks back in the easement. That is the only reason my client filed additional orders to show cause in 2016. It's not that my clients were vindictively trying to get Ms. Yasal to pay these fines. It's that Ms. Yasal was, again, terrorizing Greenhill and her tenants. That's in the record. That's not...
Hang on. So that may be... I mean, I understand that your argument is all this is justified because of the history here, and, you know, obviously that's it. Those are questions of fact. But even if that's true, that doesn't mean the district court can do whatever it wants to do. In fact, the contempt statute itself, the criminal contempt statute, NRS 22-100, limits the penalty to $500 or 25 days in incarceration, and didn't the judge order 28 days? Isn't it facially illegal?
The judge ordered 28 days. That's correct. But the way I read the statute is the person may... That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, it was 3 days in excess of the statutory maximum. But it is what it is. I don't know if Ms. Yasal actually served that much time. There's nothing in the record to say how long she was actually in jail. I have a belief that she wasn't actually there for 28 days.
Probably not, because most criminal penalties, even if she served any time at all, you start earning good time credits. Very few people incarcerated for any purpose, even for actual crimes, actually serve the maximum because of good time and all that kind of stuff. So it's probably likely they served less than 25, but I mean, my question is, how does the district court have the power to even make it 28 days, whether or not she actually serves that?
That was the district court's decision, and what he based that decision on was he made a determination that her jail time was worth $100 per day, and that 28 days would pay off the $2,750 she was required to pay back. That is what the district court said. I don't have the citation in front of me in this gigantic record, but I recall that from the hearings. So that's how the court made that determination.
Didn't the defendant in that situation, Ms. Yasal, agree to the jail time? She said, I can't do the community service, just give me jail.
In a sense, she did, yes. Yeah. So what she did was, Judge Hardy gave her the option of either paying $500 now or doing 5 days and then coming back, or doing 28 days and getting an overall at once. Those were the options presented to her on that day.
And was that for more than one act of contempt? She not only chose that, but there are multiple contempts involved at this point in time. So essentially, under the civil contempt statute, you can get up to 25 days for each contempt. Under the criminal statute, you can get 6 months. Here, since the judge did not include a purge clause in the contempt order, this was no longer civil contempt. It was criminal contempt. It was punishment, as Judge Bullitt pointed out and Judge Towse emphasized. So the court essentially treated her as, hey, you're in compliance with the injunction, but you're not in compliance with the other orders to pay this. You're not going to pay it. So I'm going to treat it like it's a criminal case, and you're going to either do the community service or do the jail. Isn't that essentially what happened?
Yes, and I also want to point out that the jail time did not come as a surprise to Ms. Yasal. In October 1st, 2013, there was a show cause hearing where Judge Escobar told Ms. Yasal that if she continued to violate court orders, and she would be put in jail. She could be put in jail, I should say. And over the course of the next several years, both Judges Escobar and Hardy warned Ms. Yasal that if she continued to violate court orders, that she could face jail time. And What I want to point out is that these judges did not act rashly or quickly. Like I said, there were 9 hearings. This went on for years. They gave her options of community service. They gave her many options. If she would have simply done nothing and not placed the cinder blocks and the planters back in the easement, this would have never came up anyway. It was her own actions that caused this. Sorry, Your Honor.
Oh, that's okay, Mr. Trebetti. I apologize. I just have a question. I know she put the planters and back once the case was transferred to a different department because she thought, oh, I don't have to comply. At least that's what Mr. Mixon indicated, and that's what's in the briefing. How long were those planters in place before she did take them down because her counsel said, no, you still have to abide by the preliminary injunction? Do you know how long they were in place?
Not exactly, but I believe it would have been several months. That's my understanding from memory and from reviewing the file today, over the last couple days, I should say. Additionally, I'd like to point out that Judge Escobar, that Ms. Yasal told Judge Escobar at least 5 times in 2013, she stated, I will not pay. So basically, she was telling the judge, I'm going to commit contempt. She didn't say, I cannot pay. She said, I will not pay 5 times. This is not indicating inability. This is indicating a refusal. It's indicating the state of mind of Ms. Yasal when she was openly, contemptuously. In fact, it's hard to imagine a litigant disregarding court orders in a more flagrant and direct manner, right, telling the judge, I'm not going to comply with the contempt order.
Trepetti, did the financial information that was ultimately provided support that she could pay?
It did support that she was on a very fixed income. So that's not in dispute. We're not disputing that. We've never disputed that. But she had over 3 years. She did not pay a dime. She had, and in the Bearden case, it even discusses the possibility of borrowing money. That's not something that's outlandish. That's something the United States Supreme Court mentioned in Bearden. It's not like we were telling her pay or go to jail. There's options. Mm-hmm. She had more than 3 years to come up with at least something or to attempt community service. She did absolutely nothing, and she told us in 2013 that she was going to do nothing. And that's exactly what happened.
Mr. Trepetti, did she ever prove that she couldn't do community service? Could she not sit at a desk and help the public in some way? Couldn't she do something even if she had medical conditions?
This is precisely what Judge Hardy stated in one of the hearings. So she did produce evidence that she had a doctor's note that said she should not do any strenuous activity. But Judge Hardy said essentially exactly what you just said, Judge, which is that she could have sat at a desk. I recall those exact words. Those words are in the record somewhere. But yes, that is what Judge Hardy said, and that is part of why he found contempt.
So she refused repeatedly to even try that, and finally, in exasperation, the judge says, all right, it's one of these things. You pay the money, you do the community service, or you do the jail time. If you do the jail time, we'll break it up. It's 5 days. And after all that discussion with counsel present, she said, I want to do the jail time.
Correct. Your Honor, could I have perhaps a minute to discuss the substantial evidence and the lack of hearsay in this case?
All right. We will extend this for another minute, and we'll see if Mr. Mixon will get extra time then, too.
Okay, very briefly then. Thank you for that courtesy. What Ms. Yasal does in her brief at pages 50 through 55 is she attacks various portions of Ms. Greenhill's testimony and argues that those portions of testimony are hearsay. But in fact, that's not what we should be doing in this exercise. What we should be doing is analyzing the findings of fact, the actual findings of fact, the file judgment, determining what Judge Hardy found, and determining whether there's hearsay non-hearsay to support those findings. I had a plan to go through each paragraph, but that didn't happen. But what I can do is tell Your Honor that there is direct testimony from Ms. Greenhill that Ms. Yasal's son cursed at her. That's verbal harassment. He refused to unlock the fence to provide access. she had more than three dogs. Mr. Deschanel admitted that on the stand, and that these dogs were caught. She had direct testimony that she herself heard the dogs. There was the no trespass sign, which there's pictures of. There's Mr. Deschanel admitted in the trial that he video recorded the Green Hills tenants. There's an admission from Mr. Deschanel that he erected the barrier. And in fact, at Appendix 458, Ms. Yasal's own counsel describes it as a barrier of, he states it's a mini barrier. There's a picture of Ms. Yasal with her chair against the house. And there's Ms. Yasal admitted at Appendix 492 that she chased, these are my words, but that she chased off the air conditioning technician, telling him he wasn't allowed to access the side of the house. So that doesn't even account for what's classified as hearsay or any statements from the evidentiary hearing.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chappiti. Mr. Mixon, you may proceed. You have 2.5 minutes.
He's on mute.
Mr. Mixon, we can't hear you. I think you might be muted.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I apologize. First, I want to address Judge Gibbons, your discussion about whether there were multiple contempt orders that could support an imprisonment for more than the 25-day statutory maximum. And I don't think that the record would bear out that there were multiple contempt orders. I think other than the first contempt for not complying with the preliminary injunction, I think everything following that was the court expressing frustration verbally that Ms. Yasal couldn't pay the fine or that she couldn't complete the community service. But I don't think that the record shows there were multiple orders finding her in contempt that would support multiple decisions to imprison her for more than that. 25 days.
Well, let me clarify. I thought that it was multiple in the sense that you have the preliminary injunction. So there were violations of the preliminary injunction regarding the use of the easement, and then separate violations or contempt for not following the previous orders.
Correct, Your Honor. But I wouldn't call there were no orders finding her in contempt. No written orders is what I'm suggesting, and
it all goes back
to the same issue of her inability to pay the fine.
Okay, if that's correct, then there definitely is a problem. How would you characterize the last day when she actually went to jail? She was handcuffed and led away to jail when you had so many things going on there, and I summarized it in 10 seconds about what was happening, but that might have been too short shrift for what to capture what really was going on.
Well, I wasn't there, obviously. She had separate trial counsel, but I don't think that you're wrong, Judge Gibbons, that she chose jail, but I think the reason she chose it is because she didn't have any good options at all. She couldn't do the other things that the court was requiring her to do, pay the fine or complete community service. The only real alternative the court gave her was to go to jail, and so her response is, okay, fine, I'll go to jail because I don't know what else to do. So I don't consider that her making a choice. I consider her consenting to the wishes of the district court. And her counsel stated that he didn't approve of her decision to choose jail, but that it was what she chose.
Well, let me just ask you, hypothetically. I mean, I used to deal with this all the time in district court. And when people had financial problems, it was recognized. However, I would say, all right, you can pay $10 a month then. Or you can do 1 hour a week of community service. So something to show me that you are actually going to attempt to comply with the court order. And even if you only have $700 a month, that's very little to live on, you can pay zero, not even $1, or you have medical conditions and you cannot do 1 hour of community service.
Well, or ask for clarification from the court on what kind of community service she can do.
Well, I think, Judge Taub, that was essentially what her trial counsel was attempting to do, was seek clarification from the court, and the trial counsel is on record telling the court that the part of the problem was the confusion created by the lack of a written order regarding community service. But Judge Gibbons,
okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I can address your point. you know, I think the issue of whether she could pay $1 or $5 a month or something like that, the record will show that the plaintiff's counsel repeatedly objected to these sort of de minimis or nominal payments. He said, there's statements, I can't pinpoint them for you, but in the transcripts of these hearings, her counsel said, if you only make her pay, you know, $10 a month, it's going to take her 5 years, and I'm paraphrasing. And he was unsatisfied with that. So I think the reason the district court didn't entertain those kinds of ideas is because plaintiff's counsel objected to it and wanted a, you know, they ended up ordering her to complete 30 hours a month of community service. That's a lot for anyone, and it's almost impossible for someone in their 70s who has a doctor's note that she's unable to perform that service physically.
So just to wrap this up, on that final day, hadn't the order been entered at this point requiring the community service? At the prior times, definitely was not there. But on that final day, wasn't it in writing?
It was 2 days prior to that. So the order was entered September 19th, and she was sent to jail on September 21.
Okay. I mean, nobody wants to see somebody in their 70s thrown in jail. But what would you have suggested the district court do in this situation had you been there?
I'm glad you asked that, Honor. I've been thinking about that. I think I would have suggested that the district court could have taken the $2,800 fine, reserved it till the end of trial, and tacked it on to any final judgment, either as an addition if the plaintiff won or as some sort of a set-off of her attorney's fees if she prevailed.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Everyone's gone way over time here, but you can see why there's some a lot of issues. They're complicated and they're significant. Mr. Mixon, we thank you again for taking this case for the pro bono program. I'm sure this was not easy to figure out this record and make sure the sequence was right on everything. I mean, you probably have a timeline that's 5 pages long.
Something like that, Your Honor. So, thank you for recognizing.
And Mr. Trapedi did an excellent job. I mean, we didn't expect you to remember every single day and hearing, and there were too many. I mean, nobody could do that. So excellent job in your presentation, too. Your clients ultimately made their smart decision, sell the house and get away from it. Life's too short. Move on and start over somewhere else.
Yeah, this was a memorable case, so parts of it were certainly easy to remember.
Judge Tao, do you have any concluding comments?
Yeah, I'll just say that, you know, we have, you know, more strict time limits up.